This is Faster, a podcast by Flow Cycling. In each episode, we interview industry experts to educate you, challenge you, and even change the way you train so you become faster. This is John Thorne at Faster. I just finished recording a podcast with Dr. Matt Miller, and he has actually a doctorate in braking on a bike, which I think is just kind of fascinating. I didn't know something like that existed. He did a lot of studying braking while he was in university and then rolled that into a company called BrakeAce. He has a huge mountain bike background, so they started with mountain biking. And what they're doing is they're using a sensor that is measuring braking and how much power is being consumed. One thing we talk about is how about 25% of the input power for most cyclists is being absorbed by the brakes. Now, they've done some road studies. They're starting to look at cross country, and this is going to eventually hopefully move over to road. And we talk a lot about how to apply brakes, how to corner properly, how to adjust your brakes from front and rear braking. And we talk a lot about descending as well, and how some of the people, you look at the Tour and people descending things like the Alpe d'Huez, and how the best descenders also know how to use their brakes properly. This does apply to all disciplines of cycling. So if you want to learn how to be faster by using your brakes effectively, check out this episode, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. When we're not creating this podcast, we're working on other ways to make you faster. At Flow, we design and manufacture some of the world's fastest cycling wheels that we sell consumer direct to keep more money in your pockets. As a special thank you for listening to Faster, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase. Simply use coupon code PODCAST in all capital letters at checkout. Your purchase will also support our give back initiatives. 1% of all sales supports our Bike for a Kid program, where we provide bikes and helmets for kids in need. We also plant one tree for every wheel we ship as a thank you to our planet. Enjoy the show.
Dr. Matt Miller, welcome to Faster. How are you doing?
Hey, John. Doing good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, perfect. So what I find interesting is that you are a Dr. Matt Miller, and you actually have a doctorate in braking for bikes, which I think is pretty cool. So tell me, how does that happen? What's your degree, and how do you get a doctorate in braking?
Man, it's a long story. My whole life was kind of building up to this point, I guess. I was doomed to be involved in the bike industry because I was a third generation bike shop guy. So okay. My granddad started a bike shop. My dad bought it off him. I worked there until I moved to New Zealand 10 years ago. I did the whole racing thing and all that, and I thought I was going to be a pro rider. But I was like, well, I'm actually a better student. So I continued on with studying exercise physiology. Eventually moved to New Zealand. I got obsessed with this thing about pacing, and that's really what kind of led to kind of the whole thing about braking and those kind of things, because we were trying to model the perfect mountain bike race. I was doing a lot of XC enduro at the time, and I was always kind of making up time on the descents because I wasn't the fittest guy, because I was training terribly because I had no idea what I was doing. a lot of people can identify with that. But yeah, so that's what led to me coming to New Zealand, working with a team that was kind of the forefront of studying mountain biking. They were studying vibrations, tire pressures, different fork systems, and then physiology of mountain biking.
Cool. And so you now work for BrakeAce, right?
Yeah. So that like kind of came out of the PhD. So we created a sensor, and it was gigantic. We have a photo on our website. It weighed like 5 kgs. And it plugged into this custom data logger we had. It was terrible to use, but we collected a lot of data with it. And we realized no one was studying braking. No one was looking at braking. So we had to make a smaller sensor. So when I left the uni in 2019, I focused 100% on BrakeAce.
Okay.
Which is kind of the commercial version of it. Yeah.
So this is your baby then? This is your startup?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not the only one. Like, I have co-founders. Okay. Like, I do everything that's not engineering, basically.
Yep.
Because there are guys that are way better at that than me. So like engineering the hardware and the software, because those are both huge things what we do.
So I think, you know, obviously you coming from a mountain bike background and a mountain bike world, obviously braking is huge there from a performance perspective. I know you guys have been also doing some stuff in the road world, but first, why don't we just kind of like break down braking in general on a bike, and why it's important to consider how we're braking, and all that certain stuff, and then talk about what BrakeAce is doing specifically to address that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, generally people don't think about braking, it's just kind of a thing you do as you're cruising. But if we like one thing that probably everyone listening can identify with is kilojoules, right? Because we get that directly from our power meter. And even if we don't have a power meter, our Garmin is probably estimating the kilojoules that we burned on, let's say an XC lap, a road ride, time trial, gravel ride, anything. We get those kilojoules. So in a mountain bike race, you're breaking away 25% of the energy that you're putting into the pedals. So that's actually a huge proportion of the braking, of the riding that you're doing is braking. So it's not all, it's not a huge proportion of time, but it is a big deal. Because if you can save a few of those kilojoules, you can, you know, go faster or save energy. So
you're saying, let me just get this straight. So I'm, as a rider, we talk a lot about like being efficient cyclist on the show. So basically we look at the input power, right? So you've got input power and then your output power is really the difference between the input power and the losses of mechanical losses, right? So you're saying that braking is a 25% of the mechanical loss of the input power of the cyclist?
Yep. Yeah. During a mountain bike race. Yeah. So we published that study in like 2018. And yeah, I was just this morning kind of trying to brush up on my numbers because we don't really talk in kilojoules usually with braking because it is a little more complicated than that. But dug into it and I did a race over the winter, normalized power 250 and for 30 minutes. And my braking was, so that was 425 kilojoules and my braking was 36. So that one was 10%, but our published study, it was like 25% just because there was more descending. So yeah, it's a big deal.
So how do you as a cyclist manage your input power to reduce the amount of loss in braking? How do you do that?
Yeah, well, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, actually, because one of the things I do on the side is coach XC riders, enduro riders, their fitness, right? So this is how it all kind of wraps together. And I was in the feed zone feeding one of my riders, and I could see everyone like pedaling really hard into this hairpin turn and braking really hard in the hairpin turn. I'm just thinking, man, what an absolute waste of energy. They could instead, you know, pedal easy into that turn and maybe not brake as much and exit with the same amount of speed or, you know, take as much time to get through that whole section if they just kind of didn't waste their energy and were able to focus more on what they were doing to get through that turn. So that's one of the ways I see kind of the braking and XC fitting in really well is like, okay, where can we pedal less hard to go the same speed and save all these extra matches for when it really counts?
Interesting. So, and that would be, are you doing something, like as you're collecting this data with BrakeAce, are you able to make recommendations based on where the person is in the course? How does that work?
Yeah. So one of the things that we do, because you might brake like 100 times on one downhill. That's a lot of times to brake. And we don't want you to look at it and say, well, if I brake 99 times, I'm going to go faster. Because that's just, you just get confused, overwhelmed. It's like, which of the 99 do you pick? So one of the first things the app does is it gives you three key opportunities. And these are the three places where you have the most room for improvement because of your braking. And that shows you what part of your braking needs to improve, whether you're braking too hard, braking too long, or over-modulating. So we haven't gone so far as to give like the AI recommendation about this is what you can do, although we've done quite a bit of that in our spreadsheets that we haven't shown anyone yet. But that's kind of the next step is like, well, this is what you did. Here's what you can try next time when you go there.
So when you say too hard, so you're basically grabbing the brakes too hard, right? Too long. So that's not, I mean, that could be like a light touch or it could be a hard touch, right? So you're braking for too long of a period. And then you say modulation. Is that basically the, you're modulating between like a hard brake and a soft brake?
Define modulation. Pretty much. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So we had to kind of make up a definition because there
almost was like ABS, like you're pumping the brakes.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the way we define a modulated brake event is one that's has a lot of spikes in it. So if it's really high power, really low power, really high power, really low power, we say that's modulated. And one of the easy things you can do if that's how you're braking in one of your key opportunities is just brake shorter over a shorter period of time, take away more speed, gain complete control and get through that section.
Is there an optimal way to brake based on the data that you've been collecting? Like, can you say that it's, you're better to brake, you're saying brake shorter. So you want to be hard and fast on the brakes as opposed to long and slow?
Yeah, pretty much. Because, well, it depends. Like if you're riding in a group, and you're leading a bunch, let's say we're leading a bunch in the gravel, if we decide that we're going to brake really hard at the last second, there's some implications, obviously, for the guys behind us. But for mountain biking, that's not really happening as much. So yeah, a good way to get through is to brake short and hard. And we classify all the events based on how long and hard they are. So something that's really optimal is what we call a stab. So you brake really hard for a short period of time and you get all your braking done and then you're off. So that allows your bike to kind of eat the terrain better. You can control the bike better because you're not focusing on braking.
So does that require, so a quick brake like that, like a stab, is that taking fewer kilojoules? Like it requires fewer kilojoules to make the same stop, to reduce the same the speed reduction? I mean, are we going based on speed reduction? So is it like, if I brake sort of long and slow, I'm reducing my speed to a certain point where I can basically make the turn, right? Or I throw a stab in there, which reduces my speed quickly. So is it all about getting down to a certain speed to be able to make the turn?
Usually, yeah, because there's basically each person has their max speed to get around a turn. And for a professional downhiller, it might be a lot different than, say, mine, you know, because they're going to brake really hard, really short, and just get through that turn. And their speed is going to be way higher than mine. But the good thing about, like let's say, a stab versus a long and slow brake event is that when you're not braking, you're going faster. And you're able to control the bike better. So that means over a given segment, you've been able to reduce the time to get through it, regardless of what the kilojoules were, just by shortening up that braking.
Oh, that's interesting. So you're saying I'm not like slowing into the turn. I have that max speed until I get there. I stop briefly to get to this, to the speed that I want. And then as I exit that turn, I can do what I want. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of benefits to that. Cause one of the unfortunate things that we see with braking, and especially turns, especially steep turns, is that riders will brake, think they took away enough speed, and then have to brake again as they exit the turn. And that dumps all their exit speed. And the result is, and I'm sure that everyone who's done mountain biking before, or even, you know, anything on the gravel, is if you take away all your speed at the exit of the turn, you just have to pedal to get back up to speed. And there's a match burned right away. So we actually see that a lot with people who kind of don't brake hard enough into like a steep turn. They just end up going too fast through the turn and then having to brake again.
We had a guy on the podcast a little while ago named Lee McCormick. Lee McCormick, he's a like bike handling guy, you know, Lee.
Yeah.
One of the things that we talked about was obviously row, anti-row, and all the stuff that he talked about from a bike handling perspective on row or on like mountain and gravel and being able to maneuver the bike. It sounds like this is also incorporating this in would also be super beneficial, because if you can get to the right speed quickly, and maintain that speed without like, you know, having to brake at the end, how does this tie into bike handling?
Yeah. I mean, your braking is the metric that we can measure that's related to your bike handling. So it kind of all ties in, right? We can't measure bike handling apart from like visually assessing what someone's doing, but we can measure their braking and then add to that the visual assessment of what they're doing to control their bike and put together kind of a complete picture of what they're doing. So I think it all ties in together really nicely, for sure.
So then how does this relate to like road? I know you said you've been doing some studies for road stuff, and then like XCA. Well, obviously we have gravel. I know you haven't done anything specifically with gravel, but I think there's some correlation there. So like, let's start with road. How do we see, what are you seeing with road cyclists?
So we did one case study where we did heaps of different trials, right? We're basically testing the limit of brakes on bikes. So one of the things that we didn't do that I'd be really interested to do is see how someone's braking in something like a crit.
Yep.
Because, man, I just think back to all the time I was racing crits. I grew up in T-Town area, like in East Coast US. So we had Thursday night crits every week. And as a mountain biker, I was terrible at riding in a group. So I would kind of like show up, fit enough. But I just wasted so much energy in the group because I didn't know how to like coast instead of brake, or, you know, stay in the wheel, get out of the draft, or just to kind of do better energy maintenance. I was pretty bad at that at the start. So I'd be interested to see what's happening in a crit with braking in that sense, because there's going to be a lot of people burning a lot of kilojoules. And I would assume that the sprinter, that whoever wins the race, is probably not wasting a lot of energy. They're hiding really, really nicely.
Yeah, I'd assume that too. There's another component there, though. If you've got a guy in front of you that hits the brakes, I mean, you're sort of required to hit the brakes.
Dude, yeah.
That would definitely
be interesting. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, so the study that you did, what did you find? Like, what did you notice in the stuff for road guys?
Well, so one of the things that we did is there's a local descent down here. It's like a 250-meter descent, and I just rode down it and measured how much I braked. So it was like 25 seconds of braking, but the kilojoules were, I think it was like 19 kilojoules over something like a five-minute track road descent or something like that. So it was quite a lot, but all the brake events had a really, really high power. And I think the average power was something like 800 watts in across every single brake event. So it was a lot. And we're surprised because we compared it to a mountain bike track and there was the same amount of braking. And we always thought, you know, braking a mountain bike, you brake really, really hard because you kind of do. But also you ride the brakes a lot when you're mountain biking. And at least in this test where I was the participant, so, you know, it's there's a lot more exploration to do. But it was either on the brakes or off the brakes. And when I was on the brakes, it was hard. And when I was off the brakes, wasn't braking at all. So that was interesting to us to kind of look at, especially the really high power that it was for braking down a road descent. Riding around town, there was like minimal braking, you know. We did like commuting, but stopping, we did some stopping tests from like 50 k's an hour. And man, the braking was so hard
in that. So if somebody is like out like doing a century or they're doing some like hill climbs or something like that, and then descents, what would you recommend based on what you know from a braking perspective? Is it similar to mountain bike? Do you think you want to stab on a road bike, or what are your thoughts there?
I think we don't know enough to make a really good recommendation for road cycling at the moment. And one of the reasons is I would hate to give a recommendation that has someone brake, like wait till the last second to brake and they find out that they don't have enough traction on the road tires to do that, especially if there's people behind them, you know? So I think the first thing is to understand what they're actually doing with the brakes. You know, there's a lot of misconceptions, and like these misconceptions have been around since the beginning. And the first one is that you brake 70% with the front brake and 30% with the rear brake. That's what every mountain biker's always been told. That's what it's just comes over from motorcycle racing. And that's just not true in mountain biking. In mountain biking, some people don't even touch the front brake. And in the study that we did, that where I was the participant, I was using the front brake a lot more on the road, you know, because braking hard, trying to slow down really fast, you need the front brake for that. But there's probably people out there that are really riding the rear brake. And that's kind of tricky if you're talking about a road descent that's slippery. If you're riding the rear brake, I think we're kind of on the edge of control. And that's a little bit scary to me. So there's a real lack, I think, firstly, of education with someone having a basic understanding of what they're actually doing with the brakes and how that affects their ride.
So on a road bike, are you suggesting like a 50-50 brake? Like even front and rear?
That's probably not a bad recommendation. I think like, obviously I'd want to see more what let's say a beginner is doing instead of an expert, right? When they're descending down a road. Because, you know, there would be some people that are probably riding the rear brake more. There are some people that are probably using the front brake more. But if you can do like a nice even application of the brakes and it's pretty much, you know, 50-50, that's like a really nice place to start. And you can try that, you know, just going down the driveway. See how it goes. How do you ride with one brake, like just the front? How do you ride with just the rear? How do you ride with both? And how does that affect your stopping?
I think there's also a fear too when you ride the front brake a lot. I know I remember the first time I ever was on a bike with disc brakes It was a mountain bike. I wasn't a mountain biker at the time. And this guy worked at a bike shop and he said, "Hey, go take this bike for a ride." I'm like, "Okay, I'll go take it for a ride." And he had his brakes set so quick and so tight that I literally endoed. Like I went right over the handlebars. It flipped the bike, right? So, and I know even as a kid, when I had like an old mountain bike, there was always that thing like, don't grab the front brake too hard because you can go over the front, right? So I've always sort of had like an even probably distribution or more rear and then add some front once I start slowing the thing down. But that's interesting, right? You know, I think if you say if you come over from motocross or something like that, that there is more of a tendency to hit the front brake. But no, even distribution seems to make a lot of sense. What about things like gravel? You say you've done some stuff with cross and or XC and stuff like that. So how would you make like a connection or any sort of correlation between gravel? What would you be your best guess there?
Well, let me tell you what I found in XC, just in like the race that I did. And then let's see if we can pick apart and see if we can figure out something with gravel, because you're probably more of an expert on gravel than I am.
Okay.
But like one of the things that I saw is like, you know, with a mountain bike race, you're often fighting for position early on and you might get stuck behind someone. Right. And it's really aggravating because you can't get by it unless you like burn heaps of matches. So you can burn heaps of matches and get around them, but then you might blow up. And that's a real risk because I'm all about pacing really well. That's like my thing. I like a good, nice, even start in a mountain bike race. But when I was reviewing some of my braking data from a mountain bike race, I found that I had one of my key opportunities early on in this race, where this is my biggest opportunity for improvement was at the start. And that's because I was stuck behind someone. So that was eye-opening for me that, you know, I, in a way, wasted some time. I should have pedaled maybe a little bit harder, got around this guy and saved some time. So that's one thing. But then the other thing that I found is in another race, I attacked someone on a climb, thought I had it, thought I could hold it. And you know, when you kind of attack, you go a bit cross-eyed. I blew up, right? Mm-hmm. So the next descent was one of my key opportunities where I was just all over the place. I knew it, but I just couldn't focus on riding smooth because I was so gassed. I'd cracked myself. And so the guy caught me, past me, and I never saw him again, right? He smoked me. Because I couldn't focus on riding smooth on the descent. So there's two things there. It's like I need to optimize better my start position. And I also need to make sure I don't attack at a silly time and can't hold on to it. Because they both affect the time that I lose. So there's some optimization I could do there.
Yeah, I mean, let's think about that from a gravel perspective. Now, I mean, there are certain races, like I've gone out and I've like toured Belgium Waffle Ride, the course out there. There's some, you know, muddy technical sections. And the way I always look at gravel is, obviously from a wheel perspective, we look at it like from a wheel selection perspective. Like when you're on road or you're a tri, you're doing anything like that, really it's how deep of a wheel can you handle? You pick the certain depth of the wheel, you're off to the races. On gravel, it's really more how well can you handle the terrain? What is the terrain? What are your bike handling skills like? And then we kind of size you with a wheel and then we pick a tire based on all that sort of stuff. However, a good chunk of a gravel race is really almost like a road race where you can be in a pack, you can be in a group to make a move. If you want to move around somebody, there's not normally a lot of like technical stuff going on. But I do think that obviously if there is a very technical section requiring some navigation, which again, doesn't happen all that much, knowing like what you just said would be very beneficial. Beyond that, I think just solid group riding skills and making sure that, you know, you are drafting when you can and doing all the proper stuff. You know, it's so funny. Gravel can be almost like a triathlon in some regards. I feel like unlike most triathlons, sometimes you hit the brakes when you come into T2, like when you're finishing, or if there's a turnaround, that's when you hit the brakes. But like you say, road and gravel, you go get all these different variations. Like if you're a crit, you're hitting the brakes all the time. It's based on a lot of the people in front of you, but in like a solid gravel race or something like that. I think understanding those basic bike handling skills and like group management in, you know, a situation where you're in technical stuff, but then outside of that, just learning, like you're saying, that to be able to apply the brakes, like even 50-50 and maybe a quick stab if you're coming into something on your own, as opposed to a long break. I think that's how I would probably make that connection.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, an interesting thing that we've all seen that we all are going to remember forever is, and I guess it's not gravel, but I'd like to see this guy on gravel. It's Pidcock's win on Alpe d'Huez maybe two mm-hmm. years ago. So you've probably seen the video where he's like passing dudes on this long descent, like he's on rails. It's absolutely insane. And then he went on to win like one of the most iconic stages of the tour. Mm-hmm. He's super fit, obviously, but he made up all that time on the descent. Like he made up a lot of time on the descent. He was absolutely ripping. And I think, you know, we could draw a parallel like that to gravel as well. Like if you can rip on a descent and be in complete control and relax a lot, because that's the other thing. Like the more you can relax, the better you recover for the next climb. So I think like that has clear implications for gravel. Bring that across, like figure out how to go down the hill fast so you can go up the next hill faster.
And how much do you think braking helped during that descent in the Alpe d'Huez?
Well, you can see him rolling up on guys that are over braking in these turns. Yeah, you know, we can only speculate, right? But the guy is phenomenal on a mountain bike. Like watching him ride at the World Cups is insane. Like he's an Olympic champion on the mountain bike. He's so good. And yeah, he was taking better lines. He was getting in the slipstream on the descent, obviously braking more efficiently, letting off at the right time to gain maximum exit speed. Yeah, he just had the perfect combo. What a day. That was, no one will ever forget that.
That makes me think, you know, you got some courses in Ironman and stuff like that too, and triathlon in general, that have some pretty hilly descents. And a lot of, I know there was a course, I think it was Ironman late, not Lake Placid, Lake Tahoe, which I don't think is a race anymore. And part of that was because the descents were so crazy. But there are a lot of people that do talk about the descents and how tired their hands get with holding the brakes and the ability to corner and descent. So that's interesting from there. I mean, that would play into triathlon quite a bit, even though you're not really around anybody because of the drafting rules, just your own ability to be able to manage the descent. We talk a lot about, especially with like wheel selection and things like that, you want to be on a wheel that you're not like worried about. Sometimes a wheel's too deep in the front. You're worried about crosswinds. You're worried about these things, raises your heart rate, which obviously impacts your performance. You want your heart rate to stay low. So if you have the inability to manage yourself in a descent at speed and understand how to brake the bike and corner the bike, that could be very interesting there as well. Mm-hmm. Do you have any plans to like make a road version or like a tri version of this to like give to people? What's the plans there?
Oh man, we would love to. I think we just need to know that people want it, you know?
Yeah.
like there are heaps of roadies and, you know, the brakes obviously look different. Like mountain bike brakes are shaped differently. So it's post mount versus flat mount. But so there's not a lot of room for the sensor, but we've obviously talked about it internally like quite a lot. I'm like, well, we don't know if people want it, so let's just focus on the other things that we got going. No. But it'd be cool.
How big is the sensor itself?
Ours is, well, here it is. I'll show you. I know not everyone can see it, but that's how big it is. It just replaces a plus 20 post mount spacer. So it goes under the caliper. Yeah. And then it's literally power meter electronics in there and weighs 73 grams. So it measures the force of your braking. And it's, pretty small, pretty tidy, all wireless, pretty easy.
And so it's an addition. It's not replacing any component, right?
Yeah, that's right. It goes, I mean, you do need to go up a rotor size. So that's in a way, plus 20. But that's it.
So basically, you could even use this even during training to understand how it worked. And then if you're worried about like drag or weight or anything like that, you could take it off throughout the race because you've learned something. You've taught yourself something.
Yeah, you definitely could. And like somebody could put it on their road bike. If you have post mounts on your road bike, it'll and there's clearance, which we haven't tested on road bikes. But I mean, it'll work the same way. The app will work exactly the same way. Like no problems at all.
Yeah, that's very cool. What is your, and I'm guessing you've not done anything with rim brakes, anything, right? Because you're all coming
around. Are those still a thing?
And road, you know, they still do make some roads, rim brake stuff. Trice has some. You know, it's always funny. I talking to a mountain bike guy, it's kind of funny. But I mean, ultimately, it is faster, right? Because especially in triathlon, like you don't need brakes all that much. And so you put this big honking rotor and caliper out there and it just gets into the airflow and causes a bunch of problems. So like, I don't personally like them all that much, but I know that's the direction the industry's going. I don't think that would change anything really from a brake performance perspective or what you're talking about, right? Like if mountain bikes still had rim brakes, it would still be the same data, right?
Trying to think back to the last time I rode a mountain bike with rim brakes. They just don't work as good. Like you can lock the wheel up, no problem. But to like get it to the point just before locking, man, that's hard to do. So what ends up happening with the rim brake is you end up braking for a longer time just because it's harder to kind of find that fine line.
So you can't really stab like you do on a disc brake.
I think you just skid. I don't know. It's hard to measure. We would need a totally different sensor. But rim brakes. Okay. I don't know. We always talk about, because one of the things that I've been talking about for a long time is bigger rotors. Like everyone should ride bigger rotors because you just don't have to squeeze as hard to get the same power. It's a really nice thing. So it saves your arms because first off, our fingers move really slow. And they're really tiny muscles that get tired quickly. Same with our arms. And mountain bikers really suffer from arm pump. It has a lot to do with how those muscles work when they're holding on to handlebars, damping vibrations, and things like that. And actually, I completely forget where I was going with that. But
so the larger rotor size, you're saying, like, what size rotor do you use? Are you on like a 200?
Yeah, on a 200 because they handle heat better and all those kind of things. But so that's where I was going with it, is the people that are rim brake diehards say, well, how much bigger of a disc can you get than a wheel? And it's like, well, fair enough. So they use that argument for rim brakes. But yeah, I'm all about the 200s. On XC, I use 180s. They get hot. And if you lose your brakes at any point, which happens more easily with a small rotor just because they don't have the heat capacity, so they just get hot really quickly, which affects the friction coefficient, which affects the fluid. And, you know, you could lose your brakes. So if you're dragging them for a long time and you have a small rotor, it's just going to heat up way quicker. So you have the potential to lose your brakes, which happened to me all the time in the early 2000s when guys are running like tiny little brake calipers, tiny little rotors, and like trying to go pretty fast.
Yeah.
Just you'd lose them all the time.
Would you put a 200 on like a road or gravel bike? Would you do that?
Oh, yeah. Nah, I think that might be a bit of a stretch. I don't even, so like, first off, I don't know if it fit, but.
Well, no, I'm saying if you could design your own, right? Like, I mean, right now, I mean, I know 140 was quite a popular thing. Now everything's kind of defaulting to 160.
Okay.
You think 160 is good? Like, I don't think there's any need for anything bigger. It'd be fun to try a 200 or like a gravel bike.
It would be interesting. I mean, you'd barely have to squeeze the brakes and you'd get the power that you need. So it would be interesting to try. I don't think any manufacturer would recommend that. But yeah, it would be cool to try, especially, I don't know. We always recommend it for someone who, because some people don't touch the front brake, like I said before. And if you're just riding the rear brake and you have like a 160 rear rotor, which is pretty common to have like the smaller one in the rear, just because the bike industry had no idea people weren't using the front brake, we recommend to go bigger. And sometimes people go bigger in the rear than they do in the front, which is kind of really against what the industry does. And that's good for heat management perspective. Mm-hmm. On the road, not sure. But yeah.
When you brake, and I'm going to ask you this in mountain because I think it would relate to gravel. When you stab like that, are you getting any sort of skidding? Are you able to understand or measure what skidding does to the performance of the run or the speed as you come out of a skid versus going into a corner where you're not skidding?
That's a good question. I did quite a bit of work during my research to just be able to like quantify skidding because it's like, okay, well, if the wheel is locked up, can we still measure power? Because the wheel is no longer spinning. So we did a whole study related to skidding on actually gravel and road, which I kind of forgot about actually. But yeah, that's what we did. So that was published in the journal Science and Cycling. And since we have a torque-based sensor, we can measure power because we know the speed of the bike. So we can kind of work backwards and measure power. mm-hmm. without actually even looking at the wheel speed, just looking at the bike speed, we can get an accurate assessment of what the power is. And that feeds into all our scores and things like that. But in terms of skidding when you're riding, a skid's a hard thing to control. So if you're skidding on trails and you're able to slide the rear wheel into, let's say, a berm or something like that, well, first off, you're going to make a lot of trail builders really angry because you're going to destroy their trails. But second off, you need to be able to be sure that that wheel is going to hook up when you need it. If we start skidding on the road or on gravel, it's a lot of times lights out, you know? Like, it's hard to recover from a skid. So I don't think we ever want to get to that point on road or gravel. And it's a little bit up in the air with mountain bikers. Like, you don't see any of the top mountain bikers in the World Cup skidding when they're racing because you just can't control it. You see them taking wider lines instead of squaring up a turn and skidding through it. And, like, you know, the things we see on Instagram, blowing dust across a berm and pretending that's fast because it's not. It's much faster to exit with a lot of speed. So skidding, it's just generally not a good idea, mostly from a trail maintenance standpoint.
Unless you want a cool Instagram video.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, if you want a few likes, definitely skid. But if you want more friends or you don't want big enemies, don't skid.
Okay, so control speed through the turn. Don't hit a skid. And so you're not really ever locking up the brake. You're always wanting that rotor to be moving through the caliper as you're braking, even with a stab.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't want to skid because you don't know what's going to happen, especially with variable terrain. Like, if you skid and at a point you're on a tiny little pebble that is misplaced, and you skid on that pebble, the pebble slides and you slide off that pebble, I think you're going down, you know? So I don't think that we ever want to aim for a skid, but you can brake really hard and not skid. It requires a lot of front brake, you know, because if you skid with the front, you're definitely going down.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I guess I've never thought about it in that amount of complexity, that really what you're doing is you're slowing the wheel as fast as possible without getting it to lock up. Yeah, that's cool.
Our co-founder, Rowan, who focuses on our software development, he's been kind of creating new scores kind of behind the scenes, and he mm-hmm. created a score like peak traction force, which is quite cool. Like, we haven't released that yet, but it is kind of interesting to kind of look at, because, like, we don't know enough about the metric yet, but it's going to be an interesting one to look at. Like, what was your peak traction force as you were going down to the descent, and how does that vary between riders and different terrain and things like that?
When you brake too, obviously there's a movement of the mass on the bike, right? Like, entering a turn, if I hit the front brake hard, that's going to throw weight forward, which is going to load the front of the bike. If I hit the rear, that's going to do something different. How are you able to brake in a way that is, and I think going back to bike handling, to be able to manage your weight distribution through like a tight corner with applying the brakes? Are you able to measure any of that with the sensor?
Well, we can measure the braking, but we can't measure what you're doing with your body. And one of the things that you'll see as you start to like adjust your body position is that you can change the way that you brake. And mm-hmm. as far as what skills coaches teach, when you're braking, well, anytime you're riding, especially on a mountain bike, you want to stay centered. And a lot of us have this tendency that when we brake really hard, we push the bike forward and push into the bike. And what that does is it changes our center of mass more towards the rear. And the result is that you kind of lose control of the front and you don't have as much traction on the front. So at the time that we need the most traction, we're changing our body position to a place where it's unpredictable what's going to happen. So
you shift, when you say push, you're basically shifting your weight to the rear, unloading the front wheel.
Yeah.
And making
that's not good.
Not grip. So for a road cyclist coming down or a triathlete, if they're doing something like that, And I always go to center road and try, because a lot of these guys don't have the same handling skills that a mountain bike guy does, or even in gravel, if you're going from like road to gravel. So maintaining a good center of balance over the bike and braking where you're not really doing anything with your weight, right? You're kind of keeping your weight centered is good technique.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what skills coaches teach. And like, it takes, like, obviously you need to stop yourself from folding onto the handlebars, right? Like if you brake really hard and you're not ready for it, you know, you don't want to collapse on your bike and, you know, eat your front tire. So you do need to be ready for it. And you do kind of have to push, but you don't want to push your center mass back.
So maintain, not push, not change. Yeah. Maintain, not change. Cool. Well, that's awesome, man. So if people want to learn more about Brake Ace, or what's the best way? Is it brakeace.com, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably the best place. Brakeace.com. Okay. There's some articles there. I don't know if
and you're selling links. The sensors now.
Oh, yeah. We've been shipping them around the world. Yeah.
Okay. And if somebody does want to try and like Frankenstein, like a gravel bike or road bike, is that something you could potentially try and set them up with to see if they could do it?
Yeah. I mean, we can't try every bike, but if they have a post mount on their frame and fork, the sensor will fit. It's just a matter of whether or not they can fit it in the rear triangle, because, you know, road brakes are in a weird position. Kind of it.
Okay, cool.
On the chainstay. But yeah, it fits on post mounts. So yeah. Okay.
And I'll ask everybody here, if you're listening and you do have interest in the road or gravel version, you guys are looking for people to know that they're interested, right? So
yeah. Upvote it, right?
Yeah. Send Matt a message or get in touch with them and let them know that you're interested in the product. I think it would be cool if they would develop something like that. One question we do ask every guest that comes on is what we call our watt point question. Normally we base it on somebody with like a 300 watt FTP. And then we say, if they take the advice of the expert on the show, how much improvement could they get? So I think this is a really interesting one, right? So I know you're coming from mountain biking, so we'll stick more with that. Let's say that somebody, and you love to pace, right? So let's say I have really inefficient braking, and then I use Brake Ace and I get more efficient with my braking. I think the question becomes, how much of those 300 watts that I'm putting in am I able to not put into the brakes? So how much of an improvement could I see in braking performance, meaning I've put in less kilojoules into the brakes after training myself to brake properly?
Yeah, like if someone wants to try something at home real easy to literally get free speed, just go to a hairpin uphill turn and coast earlier. See how far back from the turn you can start coasting and see if you can get through that turn without touching your brakes. Obviously, don't be silly about it and try it on a long, scary descent. But if you can do it on a flat into an uphill turn, just see what happens. Just coast a little bit earlier instead of braking and see if you can do it.
So in something like that, you're basically taking from whatever the kilojoule rating on that brake is to zero, right? You're essentially zeroing it out because you're not braking at all.
Yeah, well, that's a perfect utility for Brake Ace, is to kind of have you save energy that. And then have a zero there on that turn instead.
Wow. So do you believe in like the perfect mountain bike situation, downhill, cross country, enduro, whatever you're looking at, that if you were to able to optimize your power output efficiently, that you really don't need a brake?
I'm not sure if you could get around a track without braking at all, but you can save a lot of energy by improving your skills. And that was my strategy when I was racing. And really, the story that led to us starting Brake Ace, we were collecting data to model the perfect mountain bike race. I was racing against my supervisor. He was an Australian national road cyclist at one time, way fitter than me. I was able to keep up with him on a mountain bike race because he was braking. I could hear his brakes. I wasn't even touching them. So in that case, yeah, I didn't brake at all, and I was able to ride with someone way above my league. So it's possible to optimize it for sure.
Okay. Cool.
For sure.
Awesome. Listen, Matt, thank you so much for being on the show. Definitely awesome. I hope you do make this stuff for road or gravel. I think it would be cool to see the tech. But yeah, thanks for being on Faster.
Cool. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Faster. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it.
leave a review, or teach a friend what you learned today. For more great episodes on getting faster, subscribe to this podcast. While you're on your next ride, be kind to one another and ride safe.